Then Jesus taught the crowd of people and said, "You have heard people say, 'An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth.' But I say to you, do not resist an evildoer. But if anyone hits you on the right cheek, turn the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go also the second mile."
And then Jesus taught them with this lesson. "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy.' But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who treat you badly, so that you may be children of your God in heaven. For if you only love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do that? And if you greet only your brothers and sisters, what more are you doing than others? Doesn't everybody do that? Be grown up, therefore, as God in heaven is grown up."
That was the unauthorized Stokes translation of that last passage. But it actually does reflect the word in Greek. The normal translation of those last verses of chapter 5 of Matthew are, "Be ye perfect, therefore, as your Father in heaven is perfect." And that idea that we are supposed to strive for perfection, the perfection of God, is so overwhelming and unreachable that I think a lot of people just say, "Oh, well, never mind. I will never be perfect, therefore, as my Father in heaven is perfect. So I'll just sort of muddle through as a human being." But the word actually is this Greek word for being complete, or for being whole, or for being mature, or being grown up. So that's how we got to the "be grown up, therefore, as God in heaven is grown up." It has to do with maturity. And in the church, in the life of the church, we take time to celebrate the milestones in people's lives, the markers on the path through life, as we move, hopefully, toward maturity, toward being grown-ups in more ways than just the chronological passage of years. We baptize people, children and adults, to mark their entry into the community of faith. We have a time of recognition when people join the church, when they formally align themselves with a particular faith community. We have ordination ceremonies when we ordain people as elders or as ministers, when we mark their passage into a new leadership role within the life of the congregation. We commission people as they go out from the church community to be of service in the world. We have weddings here when we mark as a community the commitment of two people to a lifetime of committed relationship. And at the end of life, we have funerals and memorial services when we bless someone for the life that they have lived and bless them into God's care upon their death. We also take time every year to mark people's graduations, whether it's graduating with a PhD at the end of someone's formal educational career, or even as graduating from preschool, as all the Smiles kids did on Friday, and all the parents and grandparents were here for the preschool graduation. It's always a remarkable thing to see. If you poke your head in here, you will not see anyone's actual eyes, because everyone has a video camera or a point-and-shoot camera to record that passage, that life passage of their little 4 and 5-year-olds as they commence the next phase in their educational career. We talk about these markers as marking progress through life, but I'm a little reticent to use the word progress because sometimes that is interpreted as this sort of linear, unbroken arc ascending toward that "be ye perfect" thing that's in the end of chapter 5 of Matthew. We're not so much marking progress through life as we're marking passages, because there is always the assumption that there are some things that you learn and then you forget. And then you relearn them, and then you forget them again. And that there are some things you learn and get to hang on to. You learn to walk, talk, eat, things like that, that barring some injury or some disaster, you don't have to relearn those particular things. But other lessons in life, It's more of a cyclical path that we follow as we learn the lesson, and then we unlearn it, and then we learn it again. When you train a dog, one of the things that's interesting in dog training is you're in the living room, you got the little treats, you're teaching the dog to sit, you hold up the treat, you give the command. If you run the treat sort of back there above their nose, they tend to sit automatically, and then you say, good dog, and you give them the treat, and they finally figure out then that when you say sit, they do this, they get a treat. The interesting thing about it is then if you go outside and say sit, they'll look at you like, what? And then you do the whole little routine there. Oh, so that same thing that you said in there that made me sit down actually means the same thing out here. And I sit down. And you can see the little connections happening in their heads, which then works well until you take them to class. Every class I've been in, either I or numerous other people in the class say, but he did it perfectly at home. Sit, sit, Jordy, sit, Jordy, sit. And people are exactly the same way. Things that we learn in one context, we might not always remember the next time it comes around, and even the slightest shift in context. We can learn to be unselfish and generous, and someone needs our attention and we give it to them, and that's good. And yes, we learn that lesson about generosity and unselfishness, and then something happens where somebody needs something else from us and we backslide and we're not as generous and the selfishness kicks in and we relearn it, just like the dog learning to sit again and again and again. Until we finally get the underlying thing that the dog gets, oh, sit. That sound that my human made means I do this. Oh, generosity, right. That's the same thing in this context as it is in this context. I think I can get that. So hopefully as you cycle through, I cycle through those learning moments, it gets to the point where you cycle back out of it a little bit farther forward on the path. Defensiveness, all right? I'm learning how to not be defensive with my boss. When he comes at me with that criticism, I do the nonviolent communication thing. Okay, take a deep breath. He has a need, a valid need. All I have to do is figure out what it is, and then I need to find my own emotional place and what valid need is that pointing to within me, and then we can strategize together to some sort of mutually agreeable way to both get our needs satisfied as much as possible in that situation. Now I talk, instead of, what are you talking about? And then I go home, it's my spouse, little criticism. I can actually follow the same process. Don't react yet, take a deep breath, and move through it. The same lessons we learn over and over and over again, and we hopefully make progress. Hopefully. That's why that Robert Fulghum, a poem about all I needed to know I learned in kindergarten, that's what we're talking about. Share everything, play fair, don't hit people, put things back where you found them, clean up your own mess, don't take things that aren't yours, say you're sorry when you hurt somebody, take a nap every afternoon, and when you go out into the world, watch out for traffic, hold hands, and stick together. Those are lessons that we learn when we're 5. We learn them in a slightly different context when we're 12, slightly different when we're 25, on we go, when we keep relearning them. And the scale changes. Clean up your own mess is one thing when it's a glass of spilled milk. It's another thing when it's the Gulf of Mexico. There's also another of these, everything I needed to know I learned from ... and it's about learning from your dog. When it's in your best interest, practice obedience. Run, romp, and play daily. Be loyal. Avoid biting when a simple growl will do. And that's actually one of the lessons in my relationship with Chandler. The things we learn from the dog are the important lessons. I've probably talked about this one before. where when Chandler, for a long time, when Chandler was stressed at work at his church, and he had this thing in his head that he had to be nice to his church people all the time. He's kind of gotten past that one now, which was a good thing. So he had to be nice at work all day, so when he got home, he like didn't have to be nice anymore. So I would walk in at the end of the day, and he would sort of, and I would think, all right, so did I do something wrong, or is this work, or what do we do, and how do we work this out, and you have to sort of tiptoe out onto those little eggshells and figure out what's going on. And one time, sort of half facetiously, he said, I think you love your dogs more than you love me. And I said, you know, if you would smile and wag every time I walked into the room, I would love you at least as much as I love my dog. And that's a lesson that he and I have kept relearning and relearning. I just want to know that you are happy that the person who shares your home with you shares your home with you. I want you to look up and smile when I walk into the room. And then tell me about your day. I'm ready. And I'll tell you about mine, and we can work that stuff through, and it'll all be good. So he's slowly been learning that one and quoting that one off and on. And the other day he sent me an email about an article in the health section on the New York Times called What Pets Can Teach Us About Marriage. And it basically says what I've been saying for at least 25 years. This is Dr. Phillips, a psychologist, clinical psychologist, who says, we can all learn how to improve our human relationships by focusing on how we interact with our pets. Among her suggestions, one, greetings. Even on bad days, we greet our pets with a happy, animated hello and usually a pat on the head or a hug. Do you greet your spouse that way? So the fact that he emailed that to me means that as we have cycled through this particular lesson, progress has been made. The other two are holding grudges. Even when our pets annoy us by wrecking the furniture or soiling the floor, we don't stay mad at them. And assuming the best, when our pets make mistakes, we don't take it personally and are quick to forgive. We give them the benefit of the doubt. Yet when our spouse does something wrong, we often react with anger and blame. So Chandler now has taken to, in his morning email that he sends me every day, it says, good morning, parentheses, smile, wag. So in some ways, you know, we talk about this as though we have graduated from one phase of our relationship and are commencing the next one. And in some ways it's countercultural progress that is being made when we are able to not react in the ways that we have been trained to by family of origin or whatever it may be. Break the cycle and try something new. That's what the Sermon on the Mount is about. It's about the lessons that we learn as we keep repeating them. Love your enemies and don't hit back. Turn the other cheek and be generous. Give to those who beg from you. And if someone sues for your coat, give them your cloak. And they are challenging lessons to learn. Our enemies are our enemies for a reason, usually, a valid one or an invalid one, but there's some kind of a rationale that we have put underneath our hatred for another person. I have the right to hate that person. I deserve vengeance. He hit me first. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth is quoted all the time, not remembering that Jesus actually reversed that one a couple thousand years later. Gandhi said, an eye for an eye will make the whole world blind. So we do things a different way here in church. We hear these teachings of Jesus. We try to apply them. We try to learn about them and to teach a different way to each other and to the children of the church through repetition sometimes, every Sunday at the end of the service, return no one evil for evil, so that when you're faced with that challenge out in the world, you can remember that, oh, right. Don't return evil for evil. There's another way of responding in this situation. By repetition and by observation, we learn those lessons as we cycle through the relearning process. We learn by what we hear, we learn by what we see, we learn by what we do. And there was this wonderful event a week or so ago in the world of baseball, the perfect game that was not a perfect game. And it was an amazing thing to observe. For those of you who aren't huge fans of baseball, a perfect game is a very rare thing and a really big deal in baseball. A no-hitter is when a pitcher does not have any hits charged against them, but there may be, the pitcher may have walked somebody or hit a batter, so they still get on base, or there's an error by one of the fielders, so somebody gets on base. But in a perfect game, 27 people come up to the plate, 27 people get put out. No one makes it safely to first base in a perfect game. There have been 20-something of them in the whole history of baseball, from 1890-whatever, when they started keeping these statistics. There have a couple of no-hitters usually every season, and there have actually been a couple of perfect games this season, including Dallas Braden, whom we should all celebrate. So anyway, this was a game in Detroit, the Detroit Tigers. This young pitcher, Armando Galarraga, has just been called up from AAA. He's pitching the game, and you slowly begin to realize that he hasn't had any hits against him. Wow, he's working on a no-hitter. And you look at it more closely and realize he's working on a perfect game. No one has gotten to first base yet. And what happens when that's going on is all of the players on that pitcher's team like stay away from him in the dugout so that when he's not up there pitching, he can sit there and no one distracts him. He can stay in the zone. He can stay focused. No one would say, dude, you got a perfect game going. That's awesome. Then it's jinxed and it's going to fall apart. And the same thing with a no-hitter, but especially with a perfect game. And the crowd starts to realize what's happening and the energy gets more and more intense. And then when that final 27th out is recorded, the place explodes and everybody piles on the pitcher and it's a huge deal. So this guy's going along, 7th inning, 8th inning, he's into the 9th. He's got 2 outs in the 9th, 1 more out for the perfect game. Pitches, the guy sort of bounces one up, second baseman gets it, pitcher goes over to first base to cover, catches it, boom, boom, out, safe. The umpire blows the call. The perfect game is all gone, as if it never existed. And then all the screaming starts, you know, the coaches have to go and scream, and the crowd's all screaming, and all the players are screaming. Everybody's yelling at everybody. And the phone lines on all the sports radio call-in shows start heating up with a lot of yelling. All the chat rooms are heating up. It's an outrage. It has changed the history of the game. It's a tragedy. It's the worst call in history. The people of Detroit were robbed. And now we need to have instant replay in baseball like they do in football now. And the commissioner of baseball needs to declare that that was a perfect game and it was a bad call. Lots of righteous sort of posturing and anger and the things that happen. And I was watching all that and I thought, you know, what's really frustrating about what happened is you can't fix it. The minute that call was made, the instant that call was made, you can't fix it. And I think those are the things that make us the most angry, because you can't go back. Some things, when you make a mistake, you can go back and fix it. You break something, you can get a new one. Or you hurt somebody's feelings, you can go and apologize. You can work things out. You know, you can get to the place where everything's okay again. But what do you do with something that can't be fixed? You say you're sorry. You accept the apology. You move on. There's this wonderful saying that forgiveness means giving up all hope of a better past. You're never going to be able to get that perfect game, even if the commissioner said, oh, okay, it was perfect, which he didn't. Or even if, you know, instant video replay is instituted later on in baseball, that one's gone. But then what you saw in that story was what should have happened, because everybody was screaming and yelling except two people, the pitcher and the umpire who made the bad call. The umpire, as soon as the game was over, went in, watched the replay, and said, "I missed it." Went out to all the reporters, said, "I missed it. I'm sorry, I need to talk to that kid." Went to Galarraga, told him he'd made a mistake, apologized. The apology was accepted. And the pitcher, as soon as the bad call had happened, when you see the video of that game, he smiles, shrugs, walks back to the mound. No screaming and yelling, just, that's baseball. And one of the great things was then the next day, when that umpire was going to be calling the game again, the coach had that pitcher take the lineup card out to that umpire and give it to him. And you see the pictures of the umpire has tears streaming down his face. That an apology was given and was accepted. And Galarraga, in an interview, said, "My son's going to get to watch the video of that game, and he's going to see that his dad pitched a perfect game." That there's sort of an internal reality to that, that he was able to acknowledge and hold on to. He didn't have to say, "Somebody blew it for me." It's just like, "I pitched a perfect game, and my son's going to know that." And someone said that, that Detroit was robbed. This is a tragedy, and Detroit was robbed. It's not a tragedy. The oil spill in the Gulf is a tragedy. Darfur, tragedy. Blown call in a baseball game, not a tragedy. Detroit was robbed. Detroit wasn't robbed. Susan Hunt was robbed. Someone with a gun, that's a robbery. People get robbed. Blown call in a baseball game, not a robbery. Especially not a robbery of the entire population of a city. And someone was saying, but, now Detroit takes another hit. The ex-mayor's gone to jail, and the economy's in the tank, and people's houses are being foreclosed, and there's unemployment, and the auto industry has moved off to other places in the world. We needed that perfect game. And the commentator comes back and says, Detroit comes out of this looking great because of how that was handled. That was the perfect thing. Blown call, but a perfect response. Good sportsmanship was demonstrated, and over and above that, great human interaction was demonstrated. Counter-cultural human interaction to show us all what Jesus was saying at the end of that chapter of the Sermon on the Mount. Okay, everybody, be grown-ups the way that God is a grown-up. Amen.